This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Love and Its Meaning in the World. This is part six, the lectures entitled Love, the Mission of the Earth, part three, given on May 14th, 1912, in Berlin, and it's from the book Earthly and Cosmic Human Being. The question of the meaning and purpose of existence frequently arises in life and in the sphere of philosophy. Study of spiritual science will certainly produce a kind of humility in regard to this question. For although we know that investigation of the spiritual worlds leads thought and perception beyond the material sense world, we also realize that it is not possible to speak immediately about the primal origins or the ultimate and highest meaning of life. Here the retort of superficial thinking will certainly be, what then do we know if knowledge of the meaning and purpose of life is beyond our reach? An analogy that is entirely in line with the attitude of spiritual science and indicates what is permissible or not permissible regarding this question can be put in the following way. Suppose you want to journey somewhere. In your hometown, you can get information only about how to reach a much nearer place, but you are sent off with the assurance that once there, further help will be available. Although you make inquiries here and there as you go along, you cannot know the exact path that will take you to your final destination. Nevertheless, you are sure of arriving eventually, because you are always able to find your way from place to place. As students of spiritual science, we do not ask about the ultimate goal, but about the one line immediately ahead. In other words, the goal of the earth. We realize that it would be senseless to inquire about the ultimate goal, for we have recognized that evolution is a reality in human life. It must therefore never be forgotten that at the present stage of our existence, it is not possible to understand the goals of much later phases of evolution, and that a higher vantage point must be reached if we are to understand the meaning of a far distant goal. So we ask about the goal immediately ahead, realizing that by keeping it before us as an ideal, and striving with the right means, we will eventually attain it, thereby reaching a further stage in development. At that stage, it will be legitimate to ask about the next goal, and so on. Thus, if it is ever suggested that spiritual science might tend to make people arrogant because the outlook extends beyond the ordinary world into a spiritual world, in reality their attitude will be one of humility toward these sublime matters about which superficial questions are so often asked. We inquire, to begin with, about the goal of the earth. In other words, what is it that human beings essentially add to the fruits of the preceding evolutionary periods of Saturn, Sun, and Moon by developing on the Earth through repeated physical incarnations? Here we will recall certain matters that will help us associate concrete and definite ideas with what may be called the meaning and purpose of Earth evolution. Let me speak, to begin with, of the following. When intellectual thinking, based upon reason, came to birth during the Greco-Roman epoch, it would actually be true to say in the 6th century B.C., a thought frequently uttered was that all philosophy, all deeper contemplation upon the secrets of existence, proceeds from wonder, from amazement. In other words, as long as human beings feel no wonder at the phenomena of life around them, their life is vapid and thoughtless, and they ask, without intelligence, about the why and wherefore of existence. All philosophy begins with wonder, was a common saying during the ancient Greco-Roman epoch. What in reality does it signify in human soul life? It would be difficult today to find anyone in civilized Europe who has never set eyes on a locomotive in motion. But not so very long ago there were such persons, Now, of course, they would be found only in very remote districts. If such people see a train moving along, they feel wonder and amazement at the sight of an object going forward without any of the familiar means. It is a known fact that many people, in their astonishment at seeing a locomotive in movement, asked if the horses pulling it were inside. Why were these people cast into amazement and wonder by what they saw? It was because they were looking at something that, in a certain sense, was known and unknown at the same time. They knew that things move forward, but whatever they had seen had always been provided with quite a different means of movement. Now they were looking at something they had never seen before, and this gives rise to wonder. If people during the Greco-Roman epoch could become philosophers only when they were capable of wonder, they must have been people who perceived something at once known and unknown in everything taking place in the world, in that the happenings and phenomena seemed to contain more than appeared on the surface, something unknown. Why did the attitude of philosophers have to be that the primary causes and certain attributes of things in the world lay in a sphere unknown to them? Since it will be admitted that philosophers are at least as clever as people who give no thought at all to what goes on around them, it cannot be supposed that philosophers are capable of accepting only what is perceived by the ordinary senses. Therefore, they must find something lacking, or rather they must surmise the presence of something that sets them wondering, something not present in the world of the senses. And so, before the days of materialism, philosophers always sought the supersensible in the phenomena presented to the senses. The wonder they felt is, therefore, associated with the fact that certain things are not to be comprehended through what presents itself to sensory eyes. They thought to themselves, "What I perceive there does not tally with what I picture it to be. I must therefore conceive that supersensible forces are present within it." But the philosophers perceived no supersensible forces in the sense world. That alone is enough to make a thinking person realize that a subconscious memory, not reaching into consciousness, has persisted in the human being since times when the soul perceived something more than the actual phenomena of the sense world. In other words, remembrances arise of experiences undergone before the descent into sense existence. It is as if the soul were to say, "I discern things and their effects that can invoke only wonder in me, because they are different from what I have seen before. Enlightenment on them can be found only through forces that must be drawn from the supersensible world." So all philosophizing begins with wonder, because in reality human beings approach the phenomena of existence as beings who come into the world of the senses from a supersensible world, and find that the things of the sense world do not tally with what they perceived in the supersensible world. Wonder arises in them when sensible things are made manifest in a form that can be explained only by knowledge they once possessed in a supersensible world. Therefore, wonder points to human beings' connection with a supersensible world, to something belonging to a sphere they can enter only when they transcend the world where the physical body encloses them. This is one indication of the fact that here in this physical world, there is a continuous urge within human beings to reach out beyond themselves. A person who can simply remain shut up in the self, who is not driven by wonder beyond the field of the self or ordinary ego, remains one who cannot reach beyond the self, one who sees the sun rise and set without a thought and with complete unconcern. This is the kind of existence led by uncivilized peoples. A second power that releases human beings from the ordinary world, leading them at once away from purely material perception into supersensible insight, is compassion, fellow feeling. I have also spoken of this. Those who go heedlessly through the world do not regard compassion as having any great mystery about it. But to thoughtful people, compassion is a great and mysterious secret. When we look at a being only from outside, impressions come from it to our senses and intellect. With the awakening of compassion, we pass beyond the sphere of these impressions. We share in what is taking place in its innermost nature, transcending the sphere of our own I, capital. We pass over into its world. In other words, we are set free from ourselves. We break through the barriers of ordinary existence in the physical body and reach over into the other being. Here already is the supersensible, for neither the operations of the senses nor those of the reasoning mind can carry us into the sphere of another's soul. The fact that compassion exists in the world bears witness that even in the sense world we can be set free from, can pass beyond ourselves and enter the world of another being. People incapable of compassion contain a moral defect, a moral lack. If at the moment they should get free from themselves and pass over into the other being to feel the pain or joy of the other, not their own, if at that moment their feelings fade and die away, and something is lacking in their moral life. Human beings on earth, if they are to reach the stature of full and complete humanity, must be able to pass out beyond their own earthly life, must be able to live in another, not only in themselves. Conscience is a third power whereby human beings transcend what they are in the physical body. In ordinary life, they will desire this or that. According to their impulses or needs, they will pursue what is pleasing to them and thrust aside what is displeasing. But in many such actions, they will be their own critic, in that their conscience, the voice of their conscience, sounds a note of correction. Final satisfaction or dissatisfaction with what they have done also depends upon how the voice of conscience has spoken. This in itself is a proof that conscience is a power whereby human beings are led beyond the sphere of their impulses, their likes and dislikes. Wonder and amazement, compassion or fellow feeling, conscience, these are the three powers through which human beings, even while in the physical body, transcend their own limitations. Through these powers, influences that cannot find entrance into the human soul through the intellect and the senses ray into physical life. It is easy to understand that these three powers can unfold only through incarnations in a body of flesh. Human beings must, as it were, be kept separate by a body of flesh from what pours into their life of soul from another sphere. If a body of flesh did not separate them from the spiritual world and present the outer world to them as a sense world, they would be incapable of wonder. It is the material body that enables wonder at the things of the sense world to arise in human beings, compelling them to seek the spirit. Compassion could not unfold if one human being were not separated from another. If people lived an undivided existence, where a single flow of spiritual life pervaded the consciousness of all, if each soul were not separated from other souls by the impenetrable sheath provided by the physical body, and conscience could not be experienced as a spiritual force, sending its voice into the world of natural human urges, passions, and desires, if the material body did not hanker after things that another power must warn against. And so human beings must be incarnated in physical bodies, so that they may be able to experience wonder, compassion, and conscience. In our time, people concern themselves little with such secrets, although they are profoundly enlightening. But in a past, by no means very remote, a great deal of attention was given to these things. Just consider the world of the Greek gods, the gods of Homer. Think of their actions and activities. Try to understand the nature of the impulses working in Achilles, a being who stands like a last survivor of an earlier generation on earth. He too was born of a divine mother. Read through the Iliad and the Odyssey, and ask yourselves whether this being standing halfway between gods and men was ever stirred by anything like conscience or compassion. Homer builds the whole of the Iliad around the fury of the wrath of Achilles, and wrath is a passion. Everything in the Greek legend centers around this. The Iliad tells of what came about as the result of a passion, the wrath of Achilles. Consider all the deeds of Achilles described in the Iliad and see if you can say, of a single one, that Achilles is moved by anything like compassion or conscience. Nor is there a single example of the stirring of wonder. The very greatness of Homer lies in his power to depict these things with such sublimity. When Achilles is told of some terrible happening, his behavior is far from that of a person filled with wonder. And then turn to the Greek gods themselves. They give vent to all kinds of impulses that are certainly egotistical when manifested in a human being enclosed in a physical body, but in the gods they are spiritual impulses. However, there is no compassion, no suggestion of conscience, nor anything like wonder in the Greek gods. Why not? Because Homer and the Greeks knew that these gods were beings belonging to a period of evolution preceding that of the earth. A period when the beings then passing through their human stage, under the prevailing conditions of existence, had not yet received into the life of soul the powers of wonder, compassion, and conscience. It must be constantly remembered that the earlier planetary conditions the earth passed through, where such beings as the Greek gods underwent their human stage, did not exist for the purpose of implanting wonder, compassion, and conscience in the life of soul. That is precisely the mission of Earth evolution. The purpose of Earth evolution is to implant into the evolutionary process, as a whole, powers that could otherwise never have come into existence: wonder, compassion, and conscience. I have told you how the birth of conscience can be clearly traced to a certain period of Greek culture. In the works of Aeschylus, what we call conscience played no part. There were only remembrances of the avenging Furies. Not until we come to the works of Euripides is there any clear expression of conscience as we know it now. The concept of conscience arose only very gradually during the Greco-Roman epoch. I have told you that the concept of wonder arose for the first time when people began to philosophize in the world of Greco-Roman culture. And a remarkable fact in the spiritual evolution of earth existence throws far-reaching light upon what we know as compassion, and also, in the true sense, love. In the age of materialism, it is exceedingly difficult to maintain this concept of compassion or love in a true and right perspective. Many of you will realize that in our materialistic times, this concept is distorted, in that materialism associates the concept of love so closely with sexuality, with which, fundamentally, it has nothing whatever to do. That is a point where the culture of our day abandons both intelligence and sound, healthy reason. Through its materialism, evolution in our time is veering not only toward the unintelligent and illogical, but even toward the scandalous, when love is dragged into such close association with what is covered by the term sexuality. The fact that under certain circumstances the element of sexuality may be associated with love between man and woman is no argument for bringing the all-embracing nature of love or compassion so close together with the entirely specific character of sexuality. As far as logic is concerned, to associate the concept of, say, a railway engine with that of someone being run over, because engines do sometimes run over people, would be just about as intelligent as it is to connect the concept of love so closely with that of sexuality, simply because under certain circumstances there is an outward association. That this happens today is not the outcome of any scientific hypothesis, but of the irrational and to some extent unhealthy mode of thinking prevailing in our time. On the other hand, another telling fact points to the significance inherent in the concept of love and compassion. At a certain point in the evolution of humanity, something is made manifest among all peoples that, while differing in many essentials, is identical in one respect all over the earth: the adoption of the concept of love, of compassion. It is very remarkable that 6 or 7 centuries before the influx of the Christ impulse into humanity, founders of religions and systems of thought appeared all over the earth among all the peoples. It is of the highest significance that 6 centuries before our era, Lao Tzu and Confucius should have been living in China, the Buddha in India, the last Zarathustra, not the original Zarathustra, in Persia, and Pythagoras in Greece. How great the differences are between these founders of religions! Only a mind abstracted from reality and incapable of discerning the differences can suggest, as is often mischievously done today, that the teachings of Lao Tzu or of Confucius do not differ from those of other founders of religions. Yet, in one respect, there is a similarity among them all. They all teach that compassion and love must reign between soul and soul. The significant point is this: 6 centuries before our era, consciousness begins to stir that love and compassion are to be received into the stream of human evolution. All the signs point to the fact that in the 4th post-Atlantean cultural epoch, humankind was imbued with something that we may recognize as the meaning and purpose of Earth evolution. It is so superficial and foolish when people ask why it was necessary for humankind to come down from the worlds of divine spirit into the physical world, only to have to reattain them. Why could it not have remained in the higher worlds? Humankind could not remain in those worlds because only by coming down into the physical world of Earth evolution could human beings receive into themselves the forces of wonder, love or compassion, and conscience and moral obligation. Looking at the 4th post-Atlantean cultural epoch, we perceive during its course the dawn of impulses that in reality only from that time on spread more and more widely among humankind. It is very easy today to emphasize how seldom humankind is ruled by compassion and love, how seldom by conscience. But in pointing to these things, we must also be mindful of the fact that in the Greco-Roman age, slavery was still an accepted custom, and that even a philosopher as great as Aristotle still regarded the existence of slaves as a necessary principle of human life. We must also remember that since those days love has gained so much ground that even if inequalities still persist among people today, there is already present in their souls something like a feeling of shame that certain conditions exist. This in itself indicates the forces that entered evolution at that time are unfolding within the souls of human beings. None would dare, now, if they are to avoid the tragic fate of Nietzsche — the followers of Nietzsche can be ignored altogether, for in his right mind Nietzsche would have repudiated them — to stand openly for the introduction of slavery as it was in Greece. No one will deny that the greatest of all forces in the human soul is that of love and compassion, and that it must be humankind's task to make more and more articulate the voice that sounds out of another world into the soul. Holding firmly in our minds that the unfolding of the 3 powers described constitutes the meaning and purpose of Earth evolution, we turn to the greatest of all impulses, the Christ impulse that poured into evolution during the 4th post-Atlantean epoch. Even outer circumstances indicate that this impulse was given at the very time when the earth was ready for the development of the three powers of wonder, compassion or love, and conscience or moral obligation, as intrinsically human qualities. Many studies have given us a picture of how the Christ impulse made its way into the evolution of humankind. I want here to refer to one aspect of the Christ impulse. I have told you that certain spiritual, superhuman forces were held back in the spiritual worlds at the beginning of the evolutionary process on the earth. The Christ impulse flowed into the earth at the time indicated in the Bible, that is, at the time of the baptism in the Jordan. It was, therefore, an impulse untouched by the Luciferic forces, since it had been kept back until the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. In that epoch it streamed into humanity. If we conceive the Christ impulse to be the downpouring of the spiritual power that was kept back in the ancient Lemurian time, in order to flow into evolution during the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, at the point marked by the baptism in the Jordan, reaching its culmination in the mystery of Golgotha, then it is clear that the one known as the Christ was not, even then, incarnated in the ordinary sense in a physical human being. We know what complicated processes were connected with the man Jesus of Nazareth, so that for 3 years of his life the Christ impulse might live within him. We are, therefore, able to understand that for 3 years the Christ impulse lived on the earth in the three sheaths of a human being. But we also realize that even then the Christ impulse was not incarnated on the earth in the ordinary sense, but that he pervaded the body of the being Jesus of Nazareth. This must be understood when it is said that it is not possible to speak of a return of Christ, but only of an impulse that was present once during the time of the events in Palestine, beginning with the baptism in the Jordan, when only the physical body, the ether body, and the astral body of Jesus of Nazareth remained. Within these sheaths the Christ was then present on the very soil of the earth. From that time Christ has been united with the spiritual atmosphere of the earth, and can be found there by souls who are willing to receive him. From that time onward, and only from that time onward, he has been present in the spiritual atmosphere of the earth. The great turn given to earth evolution lies in the fact that from that time forward there was a power in the earth that it did not previously contain. We know that what we actually see in the kingdoms of nature around us is not reality, but Maya, or great illusion. In the kingdom of the animals, we see the individual forms coming into being and passing away. The group soul alone endures. In the plant kingdom, the individual plants appear and disappear, but behind them is the earth spirit, which does not pass away. So it is, too, in the kingdom of the minerals. The spiritual endures, but not the physical, whether in the animal, plant, or mineral kingdom, is transient, impermanent. Even the outer senses discern that the planet Earth is involved in a process of pulverization and will at some future time disintegrate into dust. We have spoken of how the Earth's body will be cast off by the spirit of the Earth, as the human body is cast off by the individual human spirit. What will remain is the highest substance of the Earth when its goal has been reached. The Christ impulse was present on the earth as spiritual substance, so to speak. That impulse endures and will be received into human beings during the course of earth evolution. But how does it live on? When the Christ impulse was upon the earth for 3 years, it had no physical body, no ether body, no astral body of its own, but was enveloped in the three sheaths of Jesus of Nazareth. When the goal has been reached, the earth, like the human being, will be a fully developed being, a meet and fitting vehicle for the Christ impulse. But where do the three sheaths of the Christ impulse originate? From forces that can be unfolded only on the earth. Beginning with the mystery of Golgotha, whatever has unfolded on the earth since the fourth post-Atlantean period as the power of wonder, Whatever comes to life in us as wonder passes finally to the Christ, weaving the astral body of the Christ impulse. Love or compassion in the souls of human beings weaves the etheric body of the Christ impulse. And the power of conscience that, from the time of the mystery of Golgotha until earth's goal is attained, lives and inspires human souls, weaves the physical body. Let me read that again. Love or compassion in the souls of human beings weaves the etheric body of the Christ impulse. And the power of conscience that, from the time of the mystery of Golgotha until earth's goal is attained, lives in and inspires human souls, weaves the physical body, or what corresponds with the physical body, for the Christ impulse. Only now can the true meaning of these words from the Gospel be discerned, quote, "What you did for the least of my brothers, that you did for me," unquote, Matthew 25:40. The forces streaming from human being to human being are the units integrating the etheric body of Christ. Love or compassion weaves the etheric body of Christ. Thus, when the goal of earth evolution is attained, he will be enveloped in the threefold vesture woven from the powers that have lived in human beings. Powers that, when the limitations of the I, capital, have been transcended, become the sheaths of Christ. And now think of how human beings live in communion with Christ. From the time of the mystery of Golgotha until the attainment of the goal of earth evolution, human beings grow more perfect in that they develop to the stature that is within their reach as a being endowed with the power of the I. But human beings are united with the Christ who has come among them when they transcend their own I and, through wonder, build the astral body of Christ. Christ does not build his own astral body, but humans, in the wonder that arises in their souls, share in forming the astral body of Christ. His etheric body will be fashioned through the compassion and love flowing from person to person, and his quote-unquote physical body through the power of conscience unfolding in human beings. Whatever wrongs are committed in these three realms deprive the Christ of the possibility of full development on the earth. That is to say, earth evolution is left imperfect. Those who go about the earth with indifference, who have no urge to understand what the earth can reveal to them, deprive the astral body of Christ of the possibility of full development. Those who live without unfolding compassion and love hinder the etheric body of the Christ from full development. And those who lack conscience hinder the development of what corresponds with the physical body of Christ. And this means that the earth cannot reach the goal of its evolution. The principle of egotism has to be overcome in earth's evolution. The Christ impulse penetrates more and more deeply into the life and culture of humankind, and the conviction that this impulse has lived its way into human beings free from every trace of denominationalism, as for example in the paintings of Raphael, will bear its fruit. How Christ may be truly portrayed is a problem still to be solved. Human beings on earth will have to be greatly enriched in their life of feeling if another attempt after the many made through the centuries is to succeed to some slight extent in expressing what the Christ is as the supersensible impulse living on through earth's evolution. The previous attempts do not even suggest what form such a portrayal of the Christ should take. It would have to express how the enveloping sheaths woven of the forces of wonder, compassion, and conscience are gradually made manifest. The countenance of Christ must be so vital and so alive that it expresses the victory over the sensory, desire nature in earthly humanity. Victory achieved through the very forces that have spiritualized the countenance. There must be sublime power in this countenance. In portraying the unusual form of a chin and mouth, painters or sculptors will have to express the power of conscience unfolded to its highest degree, The mouth must give the impression not that it is there to take in food, but to articulate whatever moral strength and power of conscience has been cultivated by humankind throughout the ages. The very structure of the bones around the teeth in the lower jaw will seem to take the form of a mouth. All this will have to be expressed in the countenance. The form of the lower part of the face will have to express a power whose outflowing rays seem to shatter the rest of the human body into pieces, changing that body so that certain other forces are vanquished. With a mouth like this, it will be impossible to give the Christ figure. Let me read that again. With a mouth like this, it will be impossible to give the Christ figure a bodily form similar to that of the modern physical human being. On the other hand, all the power of compassion will flow from his eyes, the power that eyes alone can contain, not to receive impressions, but to carry the soul itself into the joys and sufferings of others. His brow will not suggest thought based on earthly sense impressions. It will be a brow that is conspicuous, prominent above the eyes, and arching over that part of the brain. It will not be the brow of a thinker, which merely acts on the material already there. Wonder will be made to manifest in this projecting brow, which curves back gently over the head, expressing wonder and marvel at the world's mysteries. It will be the sort of head found nowhere in physical humanity. Every true representation of the Christ must be a portrayal of the ideal embodied in him. When human beings reach out toward this highest ideal, striving by means of spiritual science to represent it in art, this feeling will arise in greater and greater strength. If you would portray the Christ, you must not look at what is actually there in the world, but allow your whole being to be quickened and pervaded by all that flows from contemplating the world's spiritual evolution, as inspired by the three great impulses of wonder, compassion, and conscience. The end of part 6.